Anybody have any obsessive habits that, you know, anyone have a problem with procrastination? Now, this kind of goes, I touched on this last night with the thing of, you know, accepting ourselves as procrastinators, you know, who would do one thing in front of us. Adulterers, commit adultery or don't commit adultery today and give thanks if you don't have to be in anguish. But the, let's say procrastination. Procrastination is deferring things. I think the root of it is fear, sort of a perfectionism, that I don't want to do it until I'm pretty sure I'll do it well enough not to be humiliated and made fun of. And that while I'm considering how to do it right, four more things come in to do, and which now makes me have five things to do. It's much more difficult to do five things than one, and to do it well enough for my own standards. And so this is a bigger problem, so I must contemplate more deeply how to do five. And there are, by the time I start making the first move, there are nine more things. And the mail came, and I'm in despair. And so we want to get over this, you know. And so you've got to struggle around with it and pray and turn it over and so forth. And still there's a certain pattern in your life of procrastination and the kind of anguish and pressure that goes along with that. And so you've worked surrender. You said the surrender prayer, you've done this and that, and you're still opening your mail by opening this. Well, I'm going to have to do something about that. Now, what's the next thing? Advertisement. Well, I know I probably don't want it, but I wonder. So I read a little bit about it, and I might want this later. I don't know. And then there's a little bill here. Well, I'll have to pay it today. And so you've opened up all the mail and haven't made one decision. Anyway, I don't want to go on too long, but the point is, how does surrender come in this thing? If you're in the middle of something, an obsessive compulsive habit of, you know, eating chocolate at night or having multiple affairs or not making decisions when you open up the mail. And it sort of bugs you. You know, it's on your mind a lot about the mess in your desk or your kitchen. So does surrender have anything? Now, you might think, well, yeah, it says, turn it over to God and do your footwork and get it done and you'll be all right. Right? I'll do it. What about when you turn it over to God and you keep behaving the same way? And then you say, well, that's just another, I don't know, this doesn't work with surrender. I'll just put this over in another compartment and go on. And we have tried to surrender it, and we've got it in the surrender prayer, and we've done some things like that. And it still hasn't changed very much. Then there's some resistance and holding on to something that's down deep enough below the surface, but we don't have access to it. So the surrender question is, are you willing to be a person with an obsessive compulsive habit that you don't have access to the roots of, you don't understand? Are you willing to be that? Are you willing to get up today and live your life with a willingness to be enlightened, but knowing you're not enlightened yet, and you're hanging on to some old ideas and fear in regard to this thing? Are you willing to show up and know that you're not making much progress on this, but you're willing to be it? You're willing to be a person with a sex problem, with a fear problem, with a money problem, with a stealing from the store problem. You're willing to be that. You can't fake it. You've got to be really willing to have a problem you can't solve in your terms right away. But you're willing to keep on the table and not make a complete secret of tell somebody about, and to be willing to do some footwork, and willing to have the footwork not pay off in the terms you'd like it to pay off, which is make it go away, or make the guilt go away so I can enjoy myself more, or something, you know, to get the tension down so I feel better. You know, results. You know. And the surrender says, no, you don't get to pick your results. We want you to show up before your higher power with your real life as it is, turn yourself in, and be willing to do footwork, and trust God to show His love and care for you while you are unfinished, while you are voluntarily or involuntarily hanging on to some thing where you don't even understand yourself. That's the not ready yet surrender, you know. And you say, well, Father, are you just kind of making an elaborate rationalization so we can keep, so you can keep doing, or we can keep doing whatever the hell you want to do? I hope not. No. I think we can misuse anything, you know. But I know myself, and I've talked to many, many, many people. And I see people, you know, kicking themselves around and, you know, kind of endorsing surrender, but just figuring, well, it doesn't work for me and I can't do that, and I just... I see a lack of a willingness to live in the presence of God with an unsolved problem. And to work our surrender means to be willing to live with an unsolved problem, you know, and not insist we get it all together in 2 minutes, or in 2 years, or in 10 years. And to keep showing up at the place where it works, you know. To be willing to... Anyway. Back to that notion of results. I find that I have to think about this in an explicit way to work any kind of surrender in my life all the time. This is something that... You know, we say a surrender prayer, and I like to end the session with a surrender prayer. Or the transition to a meeting. But that surrender prayer gets us to have surrender as our life policy. But the fifth, so it's real. You say the surrender prayer and mean it with God's help, it changes the way you live and the way you are. But it doesn't get our whole selves into surrender every minute. It's obvious because we have a lot of conflict still. That's our life policy. So it bothers us more when we don't surrender, after we surrender, than it did before we surrendered, because we didn't know what surrender was. But every time we do anything, all the way from saying, good morning, that's doing something, up till starting a law course, up to starting a new career, up to starting a new relationship, every time we embark on the simplest little thing, or the most demanding long-term thing, we have a result in mind, and it's not bad to have a result in mind. It's absolutely inevitable to have a result in mind, because we wouldn't get geared up to do anything unless we had a result in mind. And it's fine, it's just that as we every time we start anything and there's a result in mind, as we do it, we have the habit of saying, higher power, you know what I want. I know what I want. I'd like this to work. Thy will be done, and I'm willing for it not to. To give the result away, if we think of it that explicitly. And if sometimes we can get into a habit of doing it rather easily, and that just brings all kinds of peace, all kinds of maturity into our life. But we still have the result. We hope it works, and we'll shift a little bit and hope it comes close, you know. And if it doesn't, then we reorganize and do something different and do it over again. Take it, it'll be very simple. Like, as soon as we turn over that result, then we have some security and we don't go crazy. We're not vulnerable to other people's behavior so much. If I say good morning, I have a result in mind. I'd like you to look back at me and say good morning back. Now, if I surrender the result and I'm fundamentally willing for you not to say good morning back, it'll still kind of hurt my feelings if you don't. But it'll hurt my feelings, but if I'm surrendered, after my feelings are hurt, my reaction to you will be, I wonder what's wrong with her. She must be kind of distracted or out of it today to not notice. I'll say a prayer for her. If I'm not surrendered, I'll say, you're not going to catch me saying good morning to you, you. You know, you took something away from me, I gave, you didn't. You know, I'll have hostility and I'll be upset. It's all a matter of that totally different approaches, you know. As we start out in a relationship, if we want this relationship to work, it's fine, that's human. Everybody wants a relationship to work and be nice and turn out. If we insist that it turns out, it's like walking up to somebody and putting your hand on their elbow and squeezing and saying, honey, it's up to you now to make me happy. And I'm not letting go until you do. Or if we are willing, if we grant the other person total freedom and so forth, it kills you too, you know, if you want it to work so much. But we are willing, God, please let me have the willingness to let this person do whatever they're going to do and be whoever they want to be and let them go. And then, hello. Did a little conversation. And then we can, we're much better met. We don't scare people nearly as much when we've surrendered them. The same way you notice yourself, when you meet somebody who has not assigned you the role of making them happy, you can breathe easy. And as soon as you detect any assignment, that it's up to you now to make them happy, it's hard going. And you're not living in the world of surrender. So it's just a blessing. We often think of surrender in terms of doing something that's difficult and that's a big deal. And boy, oh, I'm going to surrender and turn it over and give it away and let God's way be first and mine second. And like we're really giving up a lot, you know? We're giving up grief. And insanity and a grinding gut. See, it's really heroic, isn't it? But so often it's impossible to do by ourselves. I think one of the aspects of surrender that I find, you know, very maybe the worst, hardest myself, and I think it's very much of human nature, is to agree to have all of your hang-ups and not push them. Let your fears and your phobias and your hang-ups and everything be just as they are. And ask God to help you do the next thing that's sensible for a person in your shape. And trust God to love you and show care for you while you're in the shape you're in. That to me is the most difficult thing in the world. There's a feeling that first I got to get over this and that, and then I'll be positioned well for moving ahead. But I'm not positioned well. Wait a minute, God. Wait a minute. Let me take this. My sponsor said that the unforgivable sin is to avoid God until you're in good enough shape to fool him. Somehow, not bring it up to God until you're in better shape. You know? And a lot of times, you know, with the awareness, the ACA thing, you know, we become aware of how we get our reaction to a sick family has resulted in our being wired in a way, you know, kind of the readiness to do real stupid things, to kind of get very attracted to sick people, to to go into deep feelings of anxiety and guilt when other people are having problems. You know, take emotional responsibility for other people's problems. And Lila, and we think, I got to get over that. And Surrender says, let's walk along the path of healing in the program. Let's be willing to have your history and your wiring and the way you are, and trust God as you do the steps to take care of you with your wiring. It's not tragic. You're going to do all right. You don't have to wait until you're over something before you're allowed to breathe and live. You do footwork, but we do it in a calm spirit. We do it in a step-by-step way. I'm a little late, but you were a little late too. So let's pray the surrender prayer together now. And then I'd like you to be patient. Wait a minute. Let's count off again, okay? And we'll do this. What do we do first? Let's pray the prayer first, and then be good sports and stay where you can be counted for about 1 minute. Now let's get myself. Some of you know this by heart, some of you don't. If you don't know it by heart, just say amen at the end. God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always.
Amen.
Okay.
This is the end of session 3, the start of session 4.
There's a 6-word, 3-sentence summary of the program that you're all familiar with, I'm sure. Trust God, clean house, help others. And the middle part of that, clean house, is what I'd like to reflect on here. The middle steps of the program, taking inventory, sharing the inventory, the humility steps of 6 and 7, where we agree to let God work on us, and then beg Him to, and the amend steps. These steps are kind of under the heading, cleaning house, telling the truth. And I use the word clean house, the phrase, because it gives me the creeps so much. I just hear clean house, and there's a chill up my spine, and oh God, clean house. Got to confess and get my sins straight. And you know what that means. Once you confess them, there's got to be a firm purpose of amendment. This is Catholic language. And that means you can't do them again. And there's two results of not being able to do your sins again. One is that you really will not do them again and never have any fun for the rest of your life. Or you will do them again and feel like a failure and guilty and so forth. So it's, if you're reflecting on this whole issue in a spirit of fear, it's very discouraging. And of course, I've been talking about transformation. Transformation of attitude, transformation of spirit, transformation of the way we live, that it isn't a matter of finally getting enough strength to do what we always needed and had to be done. It's a matter of being led by our higher power to do it in another way. And I think this issue of telling the truth is right at the, maybe the, like the most stark instance of something changing in the middle. You know, the very nature of it changes as we come towards the program. You know, the fourth step comes after the first three. And the without the first three steps, it really would be stupid to take an inventory. Because all we would do is take it in our old attitude. We just write out a bunch of things we feel guilty about and feel bad, feel worse. An inventory is only safe and only makes sense when we've taken the first three steps or in the middle of them, you know, when we're drawn into them and have that spirit. And think of it this way, we're transformed from fear to faith. We're not transformed from being fearful people into being people full of faith with no fear anymore. A basic principle is that we never get over anything. We never get rid of anything entirely. Well, you can say you get rid of drinking entirely if you stay sober a day at a time. But we don't get rid of alcoholism at all. We don't get rid of our being fearful in many ways. What we do is add the program. We add the experience of being accepted with respect and love, and we add this faith thing. And as we add that, we get to live more and more in the spirit of faith while our fears are around. The more faith we have, the more program we have, the more the fears get scrunched up to the side and don't have much of an effect. They'll rush right back to center stage the minute they have room to move in. But there they are. Now, the experience we have, and I think all of us share this right here, we lived a life where you lied. I lied a lot. I lied in a very systematic, never let up way when I drank. I didn't think of myself as lying very much. I thought I was a pretty good guy. I didn't even think I was lying unless I told a big fat lie. You know? The big fat one where you just lie. You know? tell them something different. But if it was anything short of that, I didn't count it as, you know, it's like exercising your right to privacy kind of thing. But to give some notion of how consistent my lying was, I kind of did a little role-playing in my imagination of what it would have been like had I ever told the truth while drinking. Now, I never did, but if I ever had told the truth while I was drinking, it would have gone something like this. I would have gone over, let's say you invited me over to the house for Saturday night social get-together, and I knew you well enough to know there'd be booze there. And if I was assured there'd be booze there and I didn't have a better offer, I'd say, sure, I'll be over. And if I were going to tell the truth, which I never did, I would have arrived at your house, knocked on the door, you'd answer the door, and I'd say, hi, thanks for asking me over. I'd like to lay my cards on the table and get a few things straight before we start out this evening. I'm here to drink. I'd like a double scotch right now. Before we go on anymore with any talk. Now. Okay. So I get my drink. I say, look, you were nice enough to ask me over. I'm going to be a good sport. You got games to play? I'll play the games. Other people coming over? I'll mix it up. Usually this kind of an evening, I get a little bit gassed, but I do all right generally. However, it's only fair to warn you, sometimes I go crazy. And I might throw up on the rug, get in a fight, try to seduce somebody. But that's the chance you take when you ask me over. You didn't tell the truth either, did you? See, when I'm living as an drinking alcoholic, or with the whole attitude, the whole fear way of life, it is to my interest that you not know a lot about what I'm up to and what I feel and what's going on, because it interferes with the whole project if you know too much, if you know hardly anything. I never tell. And that's a way of life. And the whole people-pleasing thing, the whole screening off that I try to control your reactions by just feeding you the stuff I want you to hear. They're just so deadening, you know. Just boring, Dullsville life when we just tell each other the good stuff. You know, what we're waiting for is the real good stuff. You know, with some honesty about what's happening. So we come, and we're accustomed to this. You know, we live for years with this practice thing of hiding our weaknesses, hiding what could be embarrassing, hiding anything that could be used by the enemy to make it harder to get a drink or make it harder or find us being despised. That fear. We come, fast forward into crashing and burning and the frustration of being a co in a family with just being obsessed with trying to help out and try to change things. And this is severe for someone who is in the family disease who's not drinking, because almost all of the energy in trying to change the behavior of somebody else, when the focus is on changing behavior, good tactics always dictate that you parcel out the information very judiciously. You don't let them know certain things, you let them know other things. It's always manipulative when we have our focus on the behavior change, and you never let them know what you're really up to. It's always some kind of a little angle. And it gets them mad all the time. And there's reactive stuff. And so we come to the program with years of habit of this. And as you come in the program, come in a meeting, you hear people actually volunteering things that put them at a disadvantage in your, where you usually live, you know. I remember going to my 12-step house in New Jersey, and there was a skinny priest named Father Mike, Mad Mike we called him. And he, we'd just been to a meeting, I'd been to about one or two meetings, and he said, "Boy, do I have a resentment against that secretary of the Wednesday night Morris Plains meeting? I can't stand him. But well, I got to turn it over. I'll turn him over and say a prayer." I had never heard an adult talk like that in my life. I had never heard a grown-up person acknowledge that they did something wrong and say they were going to try to correct it with God's help. I heard confessions, but I never heard anybody just say it in conversation, priest or non-priest or man or woman. It was shocked. And I heard, and then of course the reaction to him was, "Oh yeah, Mike, he's a tough guy to get along with." There was acceptance. And then you hear more and more of this stuff. And so all the rules are changed. See, it's turned upside down from being having to hide stuff so that we won't be rejected and criticized and given a bad time and make it harder to get a drink. We get into this thing where the weight of our own secrets and the heaviness of all of this isolation and we're just not connecting, you know? We're not identifying enough to have any solace given to our hearts, and we're alone, and there's no real comfort, because it's we don't get comfort by somebody saying, "Oh, poor thing, poor baby." It doesn't give comfort. What gives comfort is someone else to tell you what they've done, and then when you say how you feel and what you've done, they'll say, "Yeah, I know what you mean." That's that, you get comfort then, you know. And so we start getting this thing where we say what's in our heart, and instead of anybody using that to their advantage, they receive it matter-of-factly, and we identify. And when that happens, that's a transformation right there, you know, on the spot. But then when it happens, there's further transformation. There's a transformation down deeper that we, because we identify and connect up with somebody and we don't feel alone anymore, well, then we don't feel so bad. And we know this is part of being a human being. And maybe we don't get over what we've just discussed and don't solve the problem on the spot. I know in my own background, I would hesitate to say things because I thought once I said it, I had to have a way to solve it completely. And I'd be skeptical about being able to solve it, never have another drink again, never have a dirty thought again, never have, the failure of courage and of perfectionism and of being a procrastinator and avoidance person. But I don't want to talk about that stuff because I don't think I have it together enough to be better. I always wanted to work it out before saying something. We don't get to work. We work it out by saying something. And we say it, and almost always, as we share what we have to share, there's a funny kind of transformation. Before, we're obsessed with results. We're obsessed with observable change, where we're more efficient or more courageous or got it together, more charming, pretty or something. And instead of the observable results being different, it's just a greater solidarity with other people that just gives a solace to the heart. And we don't even change sometimes. We, on the spot, we don't change the way we thought we'd change. We kind of keep some hang-up or you confess your hang-up. You have a fear. You can't stand to go to the podium and finally say, oh, I'll do anything. I won't go to that meeting because they have a podium. And I won't do this because I might have to stand up and say something. You say, I got it off my chest. I was honest. You still feel that way. But you may be able to do it and be nervous and be afraid of it and find out you lived. I have a little sister who's sober longer than I am in the fellowship. And she'll be 20 years sober next July. My little sister. She's afraid of the podium. She, with her brother being this maniac talker, she told a short version of her story the first time, a 9-minute version when she did her 6th birthday cake. And she's honest about that thing, but she's got this thing still kind of inhibition. So that, the way it goes. And just to sketch out this picture of the transformation still. Underline, it's not just a matter of confessing, but finally telling them. It's sharing in the atmosphere of our fellowship and program. That's what's healing. They say, well, that'd be, yeah, it's nice. Confession's good for the soul, and, be honest. That's kind of nice. Well, it's not just kind of nice. It's life-saving. You see, when we're living in our disease, we're in pain. And we're in pain. There's two levels of pain, two that I distinguish. The deep level and the surface level. On the surface level is not trivial pain, serious stuff on the surface. Broken bones, divorces, public humiliation, death of loved ones, fatal diseases, on and on. That, you say, you call it the surface? Yeah, it's pain that you know where it's coming from, and it's awful, but there it is. Then there's pain that's kind of dull and deep, and I call that the oceanic ache. That's the pain that goes along with this illness. It's a pain that's caused by the inability to be honest. The inability to be honest in an atmosphere of acceptance and trust. The inability to speak our heart so that we can be healed, so that we can be comforted. And every human being has a deep need to say what's inside and have someone else hear it and look back at us. We need to have that done. We yearn to have that done. If we don't get to do that, we are in isolation. We're in anguish because there's no connection and there's no felt understanding and love. We cannot believe we're loved if the one who supposedly loves us doesn't know our story. They just love an image, you know. They wouldn't love me if they knew. No way. That's by the way the core beliefs of the addict. Read about the sexual compulsive behavior in Out of the Shadows, a book by Patrick Carnes. And he talks about the core beliefs of an addict. That the inside, and it works for, yeah, they're pretty loud outside too. The core beliefs, he said there's four core beliefs and only one of the beliefs has to do with a particular addiction. The first is basically I'm no good. Second, if they knew the truth, they'd reject me. They'd never accept me. Third, if I have to wait around for them to help me fulfill my needs, I'd wait forever. I got to take care of things myself. Fourth, control is my most important need. Sex is my most important need. Being sexually attractive as the co is my most important need. A drink is my most important need. A pill is. That will take care, that will give solace. We need solace. We need love. We need to be connected as children of God with one another. We just yearn for that and I gotta have it. And when it's blocked off, we're at an ache. I call the oceanic ache, just that dull pain. And that's the kind of pain that puts us in jeopardy of drinking again, of acting again. With that pain, you add one of those surface pains, the death of a spouse, a real setback, you lose your job. And if it's combined with the oceanic ache, we're gone. We'll do something. We'll do something crazy. And when we get in the program, that oceanic ache begins to drain away. We still have all the troubles of life, but it begins to drain away so that once we're really working our surrender and self-acceptance and a faith leads us to start telling the truth in this kind of way that the middle steps lead us to do, and that ache begins to drain away, then all of those surface pains in life change the way they affect us. And we've experienced this already. If somebody dies and you have the oceanic ache, you have a drink because, God, you know, they died. Once we're in the program and that drains away, if somebody dies you love, I've got enough grief and trouble without drinking besides. It sharpens the motivation to be sober and increases our gratitude. And on down the line, lose your job? Well, I lost my job. I don't have much money. Insecure, I'm sure not going to drink besides that and make it worse, you know. So everything is turned, you see. Once that, our heart has the solace it needs, you know. And it's working the middle steps that does that. Working the middle steps that connects us up with God and other human beings so that we have this flow. The flow of recognition, love, understanding, acceptance. And once that's flowing and going on, we become very tough. You know, we're fragile in our own way. But once that's going on, nobody can take it away from you. Nobody can get you drunk, and nobody can get you to panic and live in control again. They just can't. Because the more pressure brought to bear, once the program's in place, the more motivation to work the program. It just locks in. You know. So we begin to do this stuff, you know. It occurred to me the other day, you know, I love paradox, as you probably are noticing. Someone was extolling honesty, you know. I think I might have mentioned this in the opening night here, but when we actually practice honesty, it doesn't, it's not a smooth deal, you know. We still have our fear affecting us, and we're not so sure about this. And there's a certain amount, there's a certain despair and sense of failure, even a sense of death in being honest. Because as we get honest, the old self dies. The old image bites the dust. You can't keep up the old front when you're talking against the old front. You know, start, oh my gosh. But it makes us feel disoriented, you know. What'll I do with my, I get the new image, you know. And as we try it out and tell the truth, of course so the instant the connection's made, oh, then the anguish is over about losing our image and that kind of thing. The other thing about the way the fourth or fifth step is constructed, it'll sound, when we still have some fear affecting the way we read and understand, and we read the made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, admitted to God, ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Okay. If you hear it in that tone of voice, it seems like this is going to be kind of a guilty kind of trip here. And there's the vibrations of blame going on there. We're going to have to write down everything that's our fault. What's your fault? What do you deserve blame for? And if you start doing an inventory with the attitude that I've got to write down the things I deserve blame for, and sometimes it'll stop you in your tracks. It's very depressing to write down things you deserve blame for. And then you could, because when we're in fear, that's a fear word, blame. And when we're in fear, we do one of two things with stuff that could be in our inventory. We either justify ourselves, make a case, make a little defense attorney before God. Well, it wasn't really so bad. I mean, your parents were like my parents, you probably would have done worse. And it's a free country, and I mean, it's not against the law, after all. Free consenting adults. We'll make a case, okay. And then if we're not making a case for ourselves when we're in fear, we will go over to the other side and just have utter contempt for ourselves. Just say, you lowlife, you are just disgusting. I mean, not only are you immoral, you're immoral in bad taste. There's no hope for you. And you go into a self-disgusting. All of that stuff is the way, is an attitude of fear. And when we take when we start doing our inventory and writing down resentments, when we write down a resentment, we're not writing down stuff we deserve blame for. There's no one around blaming us. We write down stuff that we need healing for, that we need liberation about. We write down stuff where it hurts, where we have hurt them and we have hurt ourselves by hurting, and where we need some healing. Nobody's after us. And we have a higher power who loves us and treasures us. And when we have contempt for ourselves, that interferes with our relationship with God because it's not in harmony with our higher power's attitude. Higher power has compassion and acceptance in the same way any decent member of the fellowship has when you're talking to him. If you're pouring out what's inside of you, you don't have to be the world champion Avalon or AA member. All they have to be is just a regular attending the meetings person. you know, and with full of their own fears and freak out feelings and so forth. And if you start telling them what's on your mind, they're vastly relieved you're not as good as they thought. Because now they're probably going to be able to be honest with you. They receive you with, there's no, you did what? You know, this, well, you know, has anyone ever in a participation meeting, someone got up and talked about abandoning their family in the Midwest and fleeing out here? Say, well, you know, there's consequences of that. I'm afraid we'll have to whip you. Mm-hmm. Up to every member of the group gets 5 lashes to pay the price. You know, that's not our business. That's not. It's on the other hand, the group doesn't pat somebody on the head and say, "Oh, poor baby, they probably were too demanding on you anyway." No, there's a respect for a person. It looks like he got some amends to make and some healing to go through, and we're going to stand by you while you do what's got to be done for healing. And once, you see, at that attitude, there's no reason to be defensive and make excuses, and there's no reason to despise yourself. Either one. Fear is the whole foundation of excuses and self-contempt. And once we get into the spirit of the program, it's putting down what we have to say because we need healing there. And when we take responsibility, you know, when somebody hurt us, you know, the big book says we don't dwell on the other person's inventory, what they've done wrong. If people have done wrong to you, there's never any reason to pretend they didn't. With rejecting judgment, which doesn't hurt anybody, which doesn't help anybody. But to acknowledge, that's a lot of the healing in ACA, is to get it straight. What happened and how I had a need to pretend I wasn't hurt in order to survive at the time. We get that straightened out. But if we're working the program and the steps, we'll keep moving ahead. And as we acknowledge that, we acknowledge our part. And you say, what do you mean our part? When you're a little kid, you know, you're going to blame yourself for being negative after they beat you up. You're going to blame yourself for being an iceberg and distant after you were sexually abused. You know, why do that? It's their fault. Fear. That's fear talking. There's no healing going on there. I have a little list of things that, you see, the thing is, when we write down our inventory, our part in the transaction, we're not writing down what we deserve blame for. There's no deserved blame left. There's only a searching for healing and integral that we cannot be healed unless we take responsibility for our lives. We own our own feelings and own what we do and kind of stand up with the trust that we're accepted in this group by God and other people, and people will help us walk through and get free of the ways we've handled things. For example, it can be something that isn't a sin or at all. If you're abused, you were the one they hurt. What did you put in your inventory? Well, acknowledge you've been hurt as best you can. Put it straight. But then acknowledging your own part. We might say, I acknowledge that I burdened others with the obligation of making me happy. I just decided that they had to treat me right or I would never be happy, and it's their fault. Nobody can make us happy. One of the ways we can tell we've assign someone else the job of making us happy is when we're very deeply disappointed or resentful of the other person. We're holding it against them. God damn it. We're That person hurts you. That isn't funny. But you acknowledge your hurt and reach, okay, what does the person do after they're hurt that way? Well, they have to acknowledge it. Maybe they have to even tell the person. But we don't have to get them to apologize or change. And we don't have to roll back history and have it not happen. The program says, nobody can stop you from working your program and having a life. Nobody. And we don't have to have rejecting judgment on anyone else. And we're not in the business of getting blameworthy stuff for ourselves. But to say, I'll combine this too. I kind of made a distinction. Maybe they can emerge. But the number two was, we acknowledge that we mess back when they mess with us. You say, well, why should I even mention that? That's so little, you know. I mean, the way I was treated, probably blame anybody for being distant and negative. Nobody's blaming. But if you are distant and negative as a way of coping and avoiding hurt, you have hurt yourself a lot. And you're in the habit of hurting yourself a lot. And if you can say that's what you're doing, you're one step closer to being set free from that behavior. It's nothing to do with blaming you. That's the way an inventory heals. Also good to acknowledge resentments we have against God. I found out that I resented God for two reasons. I resented him for not making me turn out better. And I resented him for not giving me a bigger payoff for my compliance. You know? I went to the seminary early and I was a good boy. Now, you know, make me good and make me, you know, let's reward. You know, it's a self-centered kind of attitude. Nobody's blaming me and putting me down for being kind of mad at God for not making me turn out better. That's what happens if you get a basic misunderstanding about what the deal is with God, you know. I thought the deal was, you know, that I'd get over everything and finally be all right and have everybody look up to me forever. You can see how this is it's the very heart of this is transformation. The woman, very touching to me, this story of a gal who heard this in a pitch, 10-minute pitch. She gave it at a convention. I don't remember the long pitch at all, but her sharing really knocked me out. And in this very brief sharing, she talked about getting sober, and then once she got a little stabilized and started getting the program, talking to a sponsor, she talked about the way she resented her father. She said, my father was so bad. He was so cruel and he abused me so much that no way, I mean, me, drop, he's a bastard. And this sponsor said, ask God to help you let it go. And she wouldn't even cooperate with that for a little while. Then finally, with the negative feelings, she thought, well, okay, I'll give it a shot. So she said, okay, I'll let go of the resentment. Then it didn't go. Stuck. Then said, well, I guess you're going to have to pray for him. Pray for him? So the big book suggests we pray for somebody. So she prayed for him. The resentment stayed. Pray for him as you would a sick friend. Prayed, still resented him. The sponsor said, okay, after a few more months of that, you'll have to escalate this to the next stage. Now, what is that? You're going to have to treat him decently. Oh, no, not that. He lived in the same town still. And he was in contact with the family. And she'd see him once in a while. Couldn't avoid it. She saw everybody else. Says, you don't have to pretend you like him. You don't Just treat him decently. Don't put out negative stuff. If you find it very difficult, but at least be civil and do things decent to him. She'd already done her foot. I think she said to him that, you know, she was hurt and they didn't work. You know, I mean, he didn't respond very well. Okay, so she went on the, okay, under the heading of treating him decently meant sending him a birthday card, Christmas card, and saying hello when she met him. So she did that for about 4 years and felt a resentment still. He finally got sick and went to the hospital for some surgery or other, and he was in the hospital, and she thought, well, under the heading of treating him decent, I guess that means I have to go by with a card or a flower or something. And so she went by and did her duty, walked in, put the thing down, said hello, hope to get better, without much feeling, and went down, and she said she was getting into her car and realized the resentment was gone. She was in touch with his humanity at last and was no longer under the oppression of his own illness. Her father was sick and couldn't love and lashed out in ways that were awful, but she was set free from his illness by working this program. It's not that we let people off the hook and mollify and say, oh, it wasn't so bad. Nothing to do with that. It's cooperating with God to set us free from other people's emotional domination of our lives by keeping us negative. You see how different this is? This is prayerful. This is honest. This requires an atmosphere in which we are given assurance that we're not blamed and rejected. And that it isn't even to our interest to find out we're innocent. You know, you don't get any points for being innocent. You don't get any points for saving God the trouble of healing you. You don't get any. It's just a matter of getting to the truth. Getting to what in us is causing us to snuff out life. What in us is walling me off from being in touch with the humanity of somebody. What in me is preventing me. What in me and my attitude and memories and things I'm holding makes me still vulnerable to the cruelty of another person who lives far away, you know, or I'm still churning about them. And the big book says, we have a program that'll give you healing from that. And it doesn't come at our time and just the way we want to. Sometimes it'll be 5 years, even while we're applying ourselves steadily. But you know that person, that woman who did that thing with her father, if she did that for 5 years, she's working a hell of a program, you know. And she was still bedeviled by that, and it was still kind of a pain. But still she was going in the direction. You know? And the whole thing is not the result, but that we go in the right direction. Sex relationships are a good field for just mentioning how the transformation is the big thing, the transformation of attitude from defensiveness, fear, and self-contempt, you know, over to faith. Because when we're, do the sex inventory or relationship inventory, where there's the things we look at, I find that being a Catholic and being a professional Catholic, I studied morality rather closely. I got down to I probably know the names of more sins than you do. I know all kinds of ways of sin. And the big book, when it does gives a couple pages of commentary on making an inventory, our lives in the sex area, it says we treat sex as we would any other issue, any other problem. And we treat relationships that are sexual in nature kind of the way we treat other relationships. In other words, what we ask is, how have I hurt others or hurt myself? Rather than, what gradation of sin did I commit and how much danger am I in? You know, which could be the self-centered, pious person's thing of getting obsessed with my standing and how guilty I am or not, which is a very unloving thing, you know, a very inconsiderate thing. And the big book's a good guide for that. The just a few comments on different aspects of relationships. One, a marriage relationship. You know, the most god-awful surrender is necessary for two people to be able to stand each other in close quarters. I'll never forget the talking to several couples in a row on a couples retreat. The first retreat I ever did, and it's an annual thing, and a lot of the couples keep coming back, and these are not young couples. These are not couples with unstable marriages. They started out with a doctor and his wife, and it was a bunch of other doctors, the seven doctors and their wives, as they call them. And then over the years, they were added and changed, but there were a few of the originals. One year, third or fourth year in doing this, several couples came in to talk to me, and they were married in an average of 35 years. And weren't talking about divorce or separation. That wasn't the issue. They had something in their relationship they wanted to discuss. And that was, well, they were stable, you know. They were sober, long-term members of the program. And after I talked to three couples in a row of long-term successful marriages, I was in awe at the depth of pain in a happy marriage. Jean Vanier, a spiritual writer that I admire a lot. He's living. He's a Frenchman who started all this chain of resonances for developmentally disabled people. Very spiritual guy, and he wrote a thing on sex and marriage. And one of his things, comments about marriage, he says, The special mode of married love is forgiveness. Doesn't mean you do a bad program and let someone walk all over you, be a doormat. No. It's just continuous forgiveness is necessary to keep the ship afloat. I think a happy marriage is one in which the couple, the husband and wife, love each other, are glad they're married to each other, would really miss each other if they were separated, and can barely stand each other. There's just something about a person who refuses to get out of your face, you know. They won't go home. It's because they are home. The surrender of letting another person be, and I think that surrender can be expressed in the mode of forgiveness a lot. Forgiving them just for being there. Forgiving them for the way they won't wise up ever. You know, forgiveness. You can say anything you want, be honest, but there's an element of a decision. You know? We have a choice of whether or not to forgive the person's presence. And you forgive their presence, and forgive this, and forgive that. And you can be honest. Say anything you want. Make your complaint. And turn over the results of the complaint. And, of course, I mentioned earlier what happens when we do totally forgive and turn over. And that is the goodness of that person becomes available to us again. And there can be some fun, you know. but that is in an inventory. There can be, especially from the Al-Anon point of view, it's very difficult. I think it's much harder for an Al-Anon to take an inventory, even though we alcoholics can't remember half of what we did. It's hard because there's so much injury done unto a person who comes to Al-Anon. As such horrendous inconsideration, you know, and insensitive, boorish, overbearing betrayals and everything. And I'm getting into it, right? Yeah, yeah. And of course it takes, you know, getting into the program, you know, to make the distinction between not being a doormat and standing up for yourself, and while standing up for oneself and being honest, to forgive. That's a distinction we can make well only when we're surrounded by people working the program. We need a lot of support to kind of understand. And so when we put in our inventory, I didn't forgive a lot. Because I didn't forgive the person who's hurting me. That's not my fault. No one says it's your fault. No one's blaming you. But if you get into the habit of having hardness of heart and protecting yourself by being tough in that manner, well, then you just get a little too tough. A little too tough for your own good. And you just get so tough that there's no comfort can get through the defense to touch your heart and be of solid. So we write down, didn't harden, held things against him and was cold and distant. That doesn't mean you're taking the blame, because there's no blame. Funny, you know, in the boyfriend, girlfriend, relationship, an aspect of the courting or the going out with somebody that kind of tickles me, it's funny, but it's tragic, is there seems to be social permission to lie and deceive and manipulate anybody that you have a chance of having a sexual relationship with. And you're supposed to be honest and considerate and respectful of everybody else. But if there's a chance, you're kind of allowed to lie in order to make a good impression, so it'll work. You know, do we? There's something about the social permission, and I think that has to be kind of looked at. And I think, you know, in relationships that have some social stigma connected, there's a mild stigma, I guess, connected with living one another without being married. Stigma connected with gay relationships. And whenever there's a little bit of a social stigma, it adds a lot to defensiveness. There's a thing, well, that's not wrong. Well, if someone is accusing us, then we tend to get defensive. And one thing about the program of 12 steps leads us always to a point where we don't have to be defensive, where we can honestly just, God, please help me see what I'm really up to and really doing and what my intentions are, and let me know if I'm hurting myself or others. Because nobody's really blaming us. And so I think when it comes to a relationship, say long-term relationships that are irregular in some way by society standards, there's still, in our inventory, we look what's the bottom line here. Not what do they say, how am I experiencing this, what do I say, what's my own conscience? And I think a guide to examining a relationship that's sexual is to take out the sex and say, how do you treat the person as a person if you disregard the sex altogether? And that tells us how we're treating a person as a person. Are we, there's a necessity of radical surrender, of being willing for a person to either love us or not love us, or make a decision to go where they want to go or not, where you are honest about what you'd like, but you have to let the person, grant them their freedom. Or we manipulate and don't treat a person right. It's not good manners. It backfires. The transformation that the program offers us is especially apparent in behavior that we would kind of all, that most people agree is, ooh, pretty destructive. Behavior that's in the sexual area that is a very promiscuous behavior where there's a lot of sex that's really impersonal practically, or so it's the kind of behavior that goes along with drinking a lot, you know. And we can say, if there's fear, there's either a bunch of excuses or utter shame and contempt. And if there's faith, there's the attitude that, you know, if you have sex with a lot of different people and you're not ready, you sure have to lie a lot. And there's something about sex where it's, you know, there's a God-givenness to the whole operation, where it seems there's a sort of a built-in message. And two people can be agreed that they're not, this is no big deal, this isn't the answer, we're not going to be a couple. But just after I bought you dinner, though. And and there may be an agreement that there's, you know, not much to do. But there's a certain, like, nature, there's a certain given about the message of sexual intercourse. And the given is just, it is a symbolic way of saying, we're in this together. And I care about your whole life, but I kind of care where your laundry is done and what your plans are and how your taxes are doing. And it implicitly says that. You didn't realize that, but implicitly. And when the endocrine system gets secreting certain little chemical messages that go out to the body, and the whole body gets ready to have some security and have some place to rest your head where they don't move fast and drop it. There's a... And whether there's... It doesn't matter whether anybody means this or not. The whole system gets ready for some kind of intimacy and love and tenderness, and then when it doesn't happen, it's like getting your chin dropped on cement. And so it's tough. And if a person looks at their own life, say, with insufficient preparation or whatever, wasn't personal enough, and says, you know, there was some damage to me and other people, and I want to acknowledge that. No defensiveness, no contempt for oneself. See, in a faith, it can be that way, and then we can talk in a way that's healing and not just circular, you know? We started a little late, and I went a little late. I should stop. Usually I stop just before I say anything about sex. And get, but I didn't get to the perversion. I had the whole page on perversions, but I don't... Come back next time. Let's pray. Let's see. We pray the Lord's Prayer, then we have the meeting is scheduled at 9.
I don't know.
Do we have a meeting? 8:45. Let's say 9 o'clock. Let's say 9. Let's stand and pray the Lord's Prayer.